Krasner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Jeff Humfeld. In today's show, Melvin Merritt talks with Carol Williams about her life story of a life devastated by mistaken identity and the battle she is waging to get her good name back. And then in the second half of the show, what does a good Christian, strong Christian woman do when her husband is involved in the drug trade? Well, we get the story from Tanya Brown about how her faith saved her family. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the show. And the 420 drug war news has moved to after our goodbyes. Up next is Melvin and Carol.
Yes, this is KKFI 90.1 on your dial with your host, Melvin Merritt. Keep your dial right here. We have a very interesting broadcast this morning. Have you ever had your identity stolen from you? If you have kept it locked here, lock here. This is Jaws of Justice. In the studio with me this morning is Ms. Carol Williams. Welcome, Ms. Carol Williams.
Thank you for inviting me.
Glad to have you here. One of the first things I would like to ask is, what were you doing in terms of your profession?
Well, I had graduated from Cinderella and Marlin School, and I was I did the bus promotion for Hallmark's cars in the 70s. I did. I was the only black to ride on this special bus. That was from the yellow buses to the way they are designed today. And then I went to New York. I've been to New York on a seminar. And when I came back from New York, I was Miss Black Pageant came to my town, Kansas City, Kansas, and offered me to be in it. And I didn't go though because my grandmother didn't want me to. But I was offered to be in the Miss Black Pageant. Then I have been in the newspaper several times, did different events and things like that. And I was the Jazz Festival hostess. When they gave the Jazz Festival over there at the Royal Stadium.
So you had a pretty interesting ongoing career.
Yes.
Okay. Give us a little background on what took place in 1997. I think that it was a turn of events that took place in your life.
Okay. In 1997, I went to the Wyandotte County Courthouse for a background check. I had been robbed in 95. And I did that. I needed it for a job. And when they did the check, 5'2", 210-pound Carol Williams came up, and he said I could go. The sheriff said I could go. And as I was walking out the door, the sheriff came behind me and said that you're under arrest. And I didn't know. I knew I had never did any criminal act before.
What county were you in?
Wyandotte County.
Wyandotte County. Mm-hmm. So you went there for
background check.
Background check. Why did you go there for a background check?
Because I had been robbed in 95.
Okay.
And the detective never did return my purse back to me.
Oh, I see.
So I was. That's why I went for the background check, to make sure I was clear.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So you were just making sure that your name was clear and
yes,
that everything
that
was
nobody
okay.
Hadn't been using my identification
because you had gotten your identity. I mean, your
my
information
I was robbed
stolen.
I was robbed at gunpoint.
Okay. And, so what mushroomed out of that, so to speak?
Wow, my life did a tailspin. Okay, 97, I was arrested, and during that time, the day I was arrested, Ernest Moore came down because he said, where were your identification? I said, they have it. He came back down and said, you're innocent, but you had to follow the process. By that time, Johnson County was here, and they shackled me up, feet, waist, handcuff, everything. And I said, I haven't done anything. And then they transported me to, well, they extradited me to Johnson County. Mm. And never told me what it was about or anything. All I know is they had me, and they shouldn't have had me because I have never did anything criminal.
So what you're saying is that was another person by the name of Carol Williams.
Yes.
Only one difference was that she weighed
5'2", 210-pound curling weights.
And you weigh?
I weigh from 130 to 145.
Wow, that is a big difference. Mm-hmm. So did they have any fingerprints or anything like that to identify or make the fact that it wasn't you?
Well, the attorney Brock made them produce state evidence, and when he did that, it showed that she opened up her own bank account with her own information and her own Social Security number. None of my information was used.
Was never lined up as
never.
the same person. Mm-hmm. However, what took place?
They went on the name Curl Ann Williams. Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, what I'm getting out of this is that the KCK PD perpetuated this identity mistaken because your identity was not actually stolen from you.
No.
It was just, you know, someone had gotten it, for lack of a better word, twisted a little bit because you guys had the same name.
Yes. They made them, the same name. They didn't look at everything. They went by just the name.
Just the name. And no Social Security number or anything
like
that?
No, we have different Social Security. It's been proven that we had different Social Security numbers. They just went on the name.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about some of the things that came out of it in terms of you not getting a job or was that back up for a minute. How many times were you arrested?
Three times.
And what was happening at the times that you were arrested?
Okay, every time I was arrested, I would go to court, and they were looking for a 5'2", 210-pound Curl Ann Williams, and I'm 5'6½, and it was dismissed twice, and then they sent me to do handwriting analysis. I went to Lemoore in Johnson County, and the man said I was not the person. Then I did one in Wyandotte County at the DA's office, and I was not the person. So I got two dismissals from Johnson County and one from Wyandotte. So in 99, I went to court for a relative, and the prosecutor was spelling the name wrong, and that would have been another case added on to him.
Meaning who?
A relative of mine.
Okay.
Okay, it would be another case. So I asked, could I stand up and spell his name correctly? And I did. So then after I left, that evening I was picked up on Minnesota because I went to get, my daughter and my son from a person's house that has, they were over visiting.
What took place?
I was walking down Minnesota that day after I had left the courthouse, and the officer pulled me over and put me in the car, and 5'2", 210 pounds came up on the register. Another police officer came over, looked at the register, looked at me, and said, "That's not her." But the officer said, I was given orders to arrest her anyway.
So what was their reason for pulling you over in the first place?
No reason. They never gave me reasons or told me what they were arresting me for. Never. They didn't even read my Amanda rights to me.
So in other words, you didn't run any stop signs?
None of those kinds of things? No.
So they were just following you, would you say?
Yeah, they had been following me. Yes, I know that for a fact because one officer had stopped me before and said, "We're watching you, and I don't know what for, and how do you dress like you dress," and stuff like that, he was saying to me. And that was harassment.
Just for our listening audience, had you ever had an arrest record?
I have never been arrested in my life until then.
Hmm. So, and they just had a mark on you for some reason for this identity switch or mistaken identity or mistaken person that had the same name Is that fair to say?
Yes, yes, that's fair to say. Because I know, like I said, when I corrected the prosecutor, she, like the relative said, she walked over to the police officer and said, go get something on her or put something on her. And I hadn't talked to him for days after that. But when I did talk to the relatives, he told me that the prosecutor went over and told the police to pick me up. And that he was still in there when she, you know, was saying it.
So when they was told to go and pick you up, what was your charges? What did they say?
They never told me.
So they never said that you had robbed anything? You had
never told me anything. Just put me in the paddy wagon, kept me in Wyandotte County 3 days, two nights, and then expedited me to Clay County.
At the time, did you have an attorney?
At that time, I, well, Brock had did it, and Mr. Brock, the attorney that they assigned to me in 97. No, I did not have an attorney at that time, but I did call him because Clay County said they were going to give me 5 years, and I went home, and I said, no, no, nobody could get 5 years for something they didn't do. So I immediately thought about my attorney, Brock. And I called him, and he said that he would send me, he never, you know, he keeps all his cases. And he said, they at it again. And I said, yes, they're going to try to try me in Clay County now. So he said, how soon do you want your this information? I said, I need it as soon as possible. And he said, next day by FedEx.
So this Mr. Brox, is he a regular attorney or he's a, well, assigned attorney from the court?
Well, he was a public defender at first, but now he's a corporate attorney.
Okay. Okay. So is he still your attorney at this time?
No.
Okay.
He was just in Johnson County when they had me in Johnson
County. At that particular time,
yes,
when you
time.
Were in Johnson County, so the courts assigned Mr. Brock as your public defender.
Yes.
Okay. So how did that turn out, you know?
Okay. I took the paperwork, the documents that he sent me to Clay County, my reverend took me, and we went over there to the sheriff department, and they told me to have a seat, and he ran up the paperwork, and they said, that's not that Curl Ann Williams out there, this is another Curl Ann Williams. So then he came out and said, you can leave, we're going to send you a letter, a picture, and a dismissal on this, because you're not the person. And I received the letter and the statement that they had on there. I mean, you know, the letter of the statement and a picture of the lady. And I have the dismissal from Clay County. I never had to go to court in Clay County because I had the documents to prove who I was.
And I noticed that when we talked previously that you said you were put on some type of database.
Oh, yes. Okay, 99. That's when I was put on the database. That was
what
right.
What type of database?
The national database.
And that national database is what kind of database?
It's all around the world.
Okay, so is that a criminal database?
It's a criminal, yes. Okay. It's a criminal database, and it's all around the world.
Okay, so they put you on a national criminal database.
Yes.
As an active criminal.
Yes.
And yet you were not an active criminal.
No.
And nor had you ever been in the institution for anything of your own makings.
No, never.
Okay. So, you know, I wanted to establish that so that way our listening audience would not be thinking in between the lines.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit. Something took place with the...
Melvin, before we do that, it's time for us to take our first break.
Okay. At this time that we're going to take our break, and we will be right back with you with Miss Carol Williams. Okay, you're back with Melvin Merritt. They're your hosts on Jaws of Justice right here on 90.1 FM. In the studio with me is Miss Carol Williams, and we're talking about an identity, not necessarily an identity switch, but it's been mistaken in her identity with another Carol Williams. And this is our subject on this morning and what we're talking about. Again, welcome to the broadcast, Miss Williams.
Thank you very much.
Glad you're here. And we were talking about that in our last talk, is that you had been placed on a database, national database.
Criminal database,
and yet you were not, you have not ever been involved in any type of criminal activities.
That's right.
And so it was one of the other questions that I was intending to ask once you were put on there. And then the Attorney General's office got involved into this situation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. After I had applied for the Census Bureau to work there, that's how I found out about that I was on the National Criminal Database. I had passed the test. They were going to put me in the office. But then they never, called me back. So I called them and I said, why haven't you called me back and placed me? And then the man didn't want to tell me, but I said, this about this identity thing? He said, yes. So then that's when I received a letter.
So he was aware of that already?
He was aware. I guess someone notified him that I could not work there because of this criminal. I was on the database, a criminal background thing.
So you had applied for a job
at
that particular agency?
Yes, I had applied. I had passed the test. And they were going to hire me because I passed the test.
And then they put a background check on you and found out that that you were involved in all of this. And and what was the activities of this other Carol Williams?
I really don't know. That's what I'm saying. It's a whirlwind for me because I don't know. All I know, I was arrested for it.
So your attorney never allowed you to know what this woman's activities were?
Well, all Mr. Brock said was that I was not the one, and the lady had been writing bad checks.
Okay. All right. So she was a check writer for bad
and
checks.
And other criminal activities.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't make anything specific in what she was doing.
No.
She wasn't robbing banks and stuff like
that.
They
never made it everything that she did. No,
but she was a criminal to the point where you mentioned, at least you was mentioning it to me, that the KBI had gotten involved in this thing.
Let me tell you how that happened. Okay, wow. Washington, D.C. sent me a letter to send the documents and fingerprints in. And I said, oh, no, they can't do me like this. So that's when I contacted, the Attorney General's office and the KBI. And the KBI said that papers had been it looks like I was in jail. My information was falsified.
Clarify KBI for our listeners.
Kansas Bureau of Investigation. And said that it looks like I was in prison, but I'm not the one that was in prison.
However, you were still on the records as a criminal.
As a criminal. I was still on the database.
As a active criminal.
Yes.
And so that caused them to kind of keep an eye on you because you were so active in their minds.
In their minds, yes.
According to this other Carol Williams activities.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever find out anything through your attorney? Were they watching her? Or
No one. After Mr. Brock finished that in Johnson County, that was it. I didn't have one for Wyandotte County when I went to that court hearing. The judge just said, are you going to pay for these checks? I said, no, I never had a checking account in my life. I never had one. Mm. And I said, no, I'm not going to pay for something I didn't do. So that's when they sent me to the DA's office for the handwriting analysis and it proven that I was not her. But like I said, 99, that's when it begun again and surfaced again because of the prosecutor attorney went and had the police officer pulled this stuff back up. This is what my belief source. She pulled it back up to arrest me for correcting her that day.
Oh, so you think that she was kind of now harassing
yes.
you?
Yes.
Because of that. Mm-hmm. Now tell us, because they had branded you with someone else's Social Security number.
Well,
tell us a little bit about
it's
that.
It's not so branded me with her Social Security number. It was that they start using my information. When they put me on the database, they removed her off the database and put me on the the criminal database for her.
Oh, so in other
words, not on there whatsoever. So someone in the unified government removed her and put me as her on the criminal database.
Oh, so it was like someone taking your picture and placing it
yes,
on somebody else's identity
and
making you the person that was functioning like this
yes,
other individual.
Yes, uh-huh, because that's a picture that they took at Wyandotte County that they put on the National Criminal Database.
Had you ever thought about, with all the technology that we live in, couldn't they have a cipher through a lot of that misidentity?
Okay, one police officer did say this when I met with the captain of police at the police headquarters, said they didn't look deep enough. And I'm going to say this right here. When they were extradited me to Clay County, my reverend and my fiancé had went to talk to O'Connor, and he gave them this piece of paper to prove what they had done. They had put my information with hers. And they told me to take this over there because I said I wasn't going to be expedited to nowhere I've never been before. I have never been in Clay County. I wasn't going to go anymore. So anyway, they said, take this paper. This will prove what they did to you. So the bailiff took me downstairs. She snatched the paper from me and read it and said, too much information, you're not getting this back. And all I know, it had a bunch of numbers, had my Social Security number and another Social Security number on there. And she took it from me. So when they extradited me, my reverend bailed me out, and he said, why didn't you give them that paper? Because it was proved what the mix-up was, because they had put me on her criminal background.
Had you had an attorney even after that? Could you keep bringing
no,
up 99?
No, I never had an attorney. I had to do this all on my own.
So Mr. Brock was not your attorney
at that time, when did he come into play? 97.
Oh, 97.
When I went for the first hearing in 97, the judge said, read your charges off. I said, false arrest as loud as I could. Mm. And then he looked down, the judge in Johnson County looked down and said, you need a lawyer. I said, I sure do. And that's when I was assigned Brock.
That's when you were assigned Brock.
Yes.
Now, with having an attorney, you know, and the information that you were happened to see, couldn't any one of your attorneys or someone that was from the legal community could have looked at this and found that they had all this information on the paper included with your Social Security number on it? Couldn't they have gotten that piece of paper as part of an evidence of what they were having?
Yes, I went to the mayor's office, Rhythm. I went to the legal departments. I went to KU law professor and talked with her. I did a lot of things, and I tried to go to the legal departments. They wouldn't listen to me.
Okay. We have about 3 minutes, and I want to get this in.
Okay.
You had contact with Congressman Yoder.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit quickly about that.
Okay. I knew I had to just keep on, and it was this lady that I met, she does a lot of work in the community, and she told me to let her read over my documents, and I took them to him. Can I say her name?
Mm-mm.
Okay. And she seen that I had been done wrong. And she started taking me down avenues and helping me. And she stuck with me until she told me about, you know, Yoger's office. And she said, send your documents in. She gave me a lot of avenues. So I followed her up on Yoger's office. And Yoger Singh told me to send my documents in. And that's how they started helping me, because they seen the wrong.
So Congressman Yoder, what did he do for you in terms of numbers?
I received a new Social Security number, and the only time you receive a new Social Security number is most of the time you're in the witness program.
Yeah, in the witness protection program.
Yeah. Yes.
And so that was something that was generally unheard of.
Yes, unheard
especially
of.
Especially with your type of case.
Because my documents prove what they did to me, and they seen what they had done. So, yes, the only time you get that is when you're in the witness program. Yes.
Okay, I got to have you back on, and maybe there's somebody that can identify that's been in the same situation that you were in and is still involved with, right?
Yes.
And but you don't have a website or anything?
No, I don't.
Okay.
And they falsified the papers to make it look like I was in prison. Plus, on the dispatch, it says that I'm a runaway fugitive.
Mm. Okay, well, I'm glad to have you as my guest this morning, and I know that everything is going to work out great for you, Miss Carol Williams, and she has been my guest this morning. And now, back into the hands of our engineer.
Now, the calendar for September 30th, 2013. The KC chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, October 1st, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. Discussions will include the pending executions of Alan Nicholson and Joseph Franklin, as well as planning for vigils leading up to the executions. The monthly First Friday meeting of the Kansas City Chapter of the Missouri Association for Social Welfare will be held October 4th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. Lunch is available for a donation. The next Hands-Off Domestic Violence Forum, sponsored by Give Yourself Real Love and Voices of the People, will be Saturday, October 5th, from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Southeast Library, 6242 Swope Parkway, KCMO. GYRL is proud to announce to our LGBT sisters and brothers, we are addressing your concerns about domestic violence. You can get involved in fighting domestic violence in our community and are welcome to share your experiences and insights. For more information, check out GYRL on Facebook or call Miss E at 816-651-0044. The monthly meeting of the Criminal Justice Task Force will be Monday, October 7th from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Northeast Choteau Drive, KCMO. If you are interested in more information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-468-7894. The United Progressives of Kansas City and many other groups concerned about our democracy are sponsoring a forum on government spying in the U.S. Sunday, October 6th at 4 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. The featured speaker is Gary Brunk, Executive Director of Kansas and Western Missouri ACLU. His comments will be followed by interaction and discussion of the issue of surveillance and citizens' rights with a panel of legal experts. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. kkfi.org. We invite you to tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for Law and Disorder. We also want to remind you that the KKFI Fall On Air Fund Drive starts Friday at 6 a.m. Please consider donating next Monday when Jaws of Justice Radio will be broadcasting, starting a little later than normal at about 9:20 a.m., when host Lee Moore will be talking to representatives from battered women's shelters in the KC area. Up next, Melvin talks with Carol Williams about her case of mistaken identity.
Good morning. You are in tune again to Jaws of Justice right here on KKFI 90.1. I'm your host, Melvin Merritt, and in the studio with me this morning is Miss Tanya Brown. I spoke with her husband, Mr. Darren Brown, about a month ago, and he was sharing with us about his experience in the penitentiary for 16 years. And this morning, we have a lady that waited for Mr. Brown for 16 years, and she has an interesting story, and she has an interesting take on it, and also that she wrote a book, and so she's going to tell us a little bit about her book, and maybe we might even touch base with Mr. Brown's book, Bugs, and so we will definitely get into that. But first of all, let me welcome Miss Tanya Brown to the studio this morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Mary.
Good to have you here. Let's get right into our talk this morning. Tell us a little bit about your story about when you were a young lady and you were still going to school at this particular time. And tell us a little bit, what year was that, you know, when you were going to school?
What year?
You don't have to.
All right. I was 14 years old, actually, when I met Darren. I graduated in 1983, so at 14, my freshman year, which would have been 1979, when I initially met Mr. Brown. He saw me when school first started. I was coming down the stairs at our high school, and he hollered over, "Man, I got to have you." And I thought, no way. No way. And went on about my business. Anyway, he tried for that year to talk to me all the time, and I just ignored him. I had no interest at all in Darren. And then my sophomore year, one day, I was coming home, leaving the school actually from cheerleading practice, and he asked if he could walk me home. And for whatever reason that day, I said yes. And he walked me home, and I fell in love with this Darren Brown. Changed my life forever.
So this began to kind of somewhat started a whirlwind of a relationship with Mr. Brown.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what was going on with the relationship a little bit, but what was going on, too, from your perspective as it related to Mr. Brown.
Initially, it was all good with Mr. Brown. We had a wonderful friendship, a wonderful relationship. It wasn't until several years later that Mr. Brown started getting involved in the drug scene. Mm-hmm. We were married in 1986. In 1987 was when Mr. Brown told me that he had an addiction to cocaine, mm-hmm. and that he needed some help. And so that started a whole nother process. I didn't know anybody that used drugs. I had never used drugs, so I hadn't been exposed to that kind of environment. So this opened up a whole new world for me, something I was totally unfamiliar with. I didn't know what to expect from this statement.
So it was like a rude awakening.
Right. It was a rude awakening.
So what was taken, did you, out of this, during this process and during this time when you were finding out about his drug activities, was a family evolving out of this? Or?
Well, when Darren told me that he had the addiction, we had one baby, and I was pregnant with our second child. My mm-hmm. oldest daughter was close to a year old, and I was pregnant with our second child at this time. Initially, it was an issue that he was having. It wasn't as impactful for us at this point. Mm-hmm. But as the next couple of years went on, it got real.
It started impacting the entire family.
To our family.
Tell us, in what kind of way did it impact your
family?
Well,
one, he then could not keep a job. He worked, and his character is he's a very hard worker. Mm-hmm. But so he could get a job easily and work and do any and everything they needed him to do. But when he got the check, then he would go spend the money
somewhere else.
Getting high, which then meant he couldn't make it back to work. So then he couldn't keep the job, and we didn't get the money most of the time. I mean, he was the kind of person, if he made it home with the money, he'd give you his whole check. He didn't care because that was his heart.
Yeah.
But cocaine doesn't have respect for other people. So if you didn't get to him before he got to the streets, you just didn't get any money.
So was it ever any time that Mr. Brown, in his activities, did he ever come home, or was he absent from home?
Now, when he would go get high, he initially would just be out late. He would always come home. When it got towards the end of him being addicted to cocaine, closer to the end it got, the worse it got. So he would be gone for maybe the whole day, half the night. Then he started being 2 days at a time. Right before he stopped smoking cocaine, he was gone for 3 weeks. We had no idea where he was, what was going on with him, whether he was dead or alive. It was horrible. I spent a lot of time praying for him because I didn't know what was going on with him. We had no idea, me and my family and my siblings. Spent a lot of time in prayer for him, covering him, because we had no idea. Nobody had seen him. We didn't know what was going on.
You're aware that someone may be listening to this broadcast that might be involved with the same identical thing right now. But one of the other questions that I wanted to ask, getting right into some of the meat of this topic, what was some of the things that was going on, especially when the addiction got worse in terms of his activities, criminal activities?
Okay. The Darren Brown that was in the street and the Darren Brown that was at home was not always the same person. Mm-hmm. But as he got worse, he would take things, he would take money. If he could get to your money, I oftentimes didn't leave money for him to get.
Mm-hmm.
I was smarter than that. If
so
he was spending up
his
money, then I knew, you know, I couldn't let him get to my money. So that didn't happen very often. But there were times when he would take clothes. We'd buy new clothes or something. You know, he'd take it back to the store and go smoke up the money. Or he'd take something from somebody else and go smoke up. Go smoke up the money.
So when you say take something from someone else, you mean stealing it?
Yeah, he was definitely stealing.
What about food?
No, food was never an issue. Actually, it was kind of funny because even though he was doing all these other things at home, he would still take care of the kids. He would cook dinner. He would clean the house. He would iron our clothes. He was like this really good person on this hand, and then he was totally out of order on.
You kind of paint the picture like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which drugs would make you turn into that
That's
type
exactly
of a person.
That's exactly what it felt like,
yeah.
Living with two different people.
And because when I mentioned and alluded to the fact that, you know, what about food? Because I've heard where people will take the frozen food out the refrigerator and go sell that food. I've heard of that. So as time went on, what else was going on in terms of the policeman involved and things like that?
Now, as far as we were concerned, we were never involved with that piece of it. Darren got involved in a lot of activity. As time went on, he ended up being free, which with much prayer, he stopped smoking the cocaine, but then he immediately started selling it, which then that became a whole nother ball game, dealing with somebody selling drugs. And it was at that point that I asked him to leave our home because I didn't want somebody coming to our house looking for him or somebody trying
to purchase something.
Yeah. I didn't want our kids. And he said that he would never expose our children to any danger, but I didn't want to take that chance. I asked him to leave, and then he went to stay at the dope house. And who knows all the things that went on at that point. But I didn't want our children to be exposed to that kind of life. And so we stayed as far away from that as far as they knew that life didn't exist. They had never seen.
You kept them chilled from
right,
that.
I shielded and protected them from that. They never saw anything. I never talked about him in that manner at all. So they didn't know anything about that lifestyle at all.
Mm. So bring us up to a point where, because I mentioned about more involvement with the police department and his activities as related to his drug activities.
Now, there was one point where I was contacted from the police, and this is the only time that I ever had any communication with the police at all. But there was one time that they contacted me and said that my vehicle had been spotted at the dope house. In other words, we're watching you or watching your vehicle because we think that there's some drug activity going on and your vehicle is being used for this. And so at that point, I became angry because I didn't want to be associated
with anything
in any
like
manner.
That. Yeah. Let me establish this, because Mr. Brown had been in the studio a month ago talking about his own story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we know, and Mr. Brown is in the studio right now, so we're not like dragging him through them, but we're telling a story that so many other people that can identify with here in Kansas City or anywhere in anybody's city.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a isolated type of situation.
Yes, sir.
So, but now that your car is, you know, has been spotted, and now that you're getting really worried and concerned about you getting swept up into some of this activity, and you begin to make some decisions, some strong decisions in terms of keeping your family safe when this drug had engulfed your husband, whom you love. And tell us a little bit.
Now, and I did love him. I loved him from the bottom of my heart. I loved him. And I wanted him to be free. I didn't want to be without him. I only wanted him to be free from the strongholds that he had.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept my vehicle away from him at that point because I just didn't want them to think I was involved in any way. So I didn't allow him to have the vehicle at the drug houses anymore. I did what I had to do. Sometimes tough love
is
what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
I had prayed about that. I had talked to my pastor about that. I didn't want to be enabling his situation.
You took the words right out of my mouth because I was going to ask, had you started enabling him?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the enablingness is buying cigarettes for an individual that's practicing or buying things that they could have bought for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's a form of enabling the person to.
No, I never did that. I never did that at all. But I felt even allowing him to stay in our home when he was taken away and not adding to was starting to enable him. And that's one of the reasons why I asked him to leave, not because I didn't want to be with him, because I did want to be with him, but I wanted him to get free. And sometimes the only way people can get free is to lose what they have, or either think they losing what they have, so they can get their act together. And funny, because later he told me, if you had did that a long time ago, I might would have got free because I didn't want to be without you. Because it wasn't very long after I put him out that he got arrested just a few months. So the drug selling only lasted maybe 3 or 4 months before he was actually arrested and then facing 40 years in prison.
Wow. So he was facing for for dealing drugs or selling drugs and stuff like that?
Yes, he okay. was. And initially they told us that he was looking at 40 years when they first arrested him. And I'm thinking, Lord, how could you get 40 years for a first-time offense? You know, mm-hmm. he's only been selling drugs 3 or 4 months. But the problem was it was already a case that they had been watching before he ever got involved. So he got involved just in time to get arrested and go to prison.
So it was because of his associations, you know.
Exactly.
And he got swept up into them watching someone else.
Exactly.
And he became part of that watch.
Just in time.
Yeah. So now take us to the point when he did get arrested. And what was that like?
Okay. When he called me to say that he had been arrested, initially, I just brushed it off. You know, I'm thinking this is just another one of his ploys. I wasn't paying any attention to that. I didn't think it was anything serious. And but after a few days, him calling back saying, you know, no, he because you're thinking, you know, he went to jail for something stupid. He'll be out in 2 days or something. I didn't think it was anything serious. But when he didn't get out after a few days and he's calling back saying, no, I'm looking
this
at
is serious.
Drug charges, I'm thinking, oh, my God, because in spite of the issues that he had, in spite of him not even staying in our home at the time, I still was very dependent up on him. Mm-hmm. He was a great father to his children, and he did everything physically for me. He cleaned the house, he cooked, he took care of the kids, he did everything. You just couldn't get the money from him. So it was even hard for me to put him out. Mm-hmm. I put him out for his sake, mm-hmm. not for ours, because I needed him to see that what he was doing was wrong. I didn't put him out because
that
I didn't want to
mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be with him, because I depended on him greatly for our day-to-day function. Mm-hmm. And so when he got arrested, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, this was devastating for mm-hmm. me, because what am I going to do without Darren Brown is what I thought. And we went through the process, starting off, like I said, they initially told us he was looking at 40 years, and they eventually that was reduced to a 15-year sentence.
Okay. So now that he's arrested and he's in the penitentiary and serving 15 years or 16 years in the penitentiary, now what's taking place now with you?
Now I have these children to raise, and that was my main concern. Mm-hmm. I had two children. He had a son before we were married, and so he had three children now, and then when he was initially arrested, we had the three. Are we down already? And he was out on bond, and I got pregnant with our fourth child. So now I'm left with these three children to raise and another son that I have to help with as well. And we have no father. So my life to me is like everything that I dreamed about for my family had just went down the drain. My children don't have a father. And
we only have a few minutes left on the broadcast. Tell us, you wrote a book. Tell us a little bit about this book and why you wrote it.
Okay, the book is entitled A Woman's Worth. The book was initially written to help other people who were involved in similar situations, to give them hope, to give them answers, to show them things that they could do to help them get out of the situation that they're in. But after starting the book, it changed. The book literally transformed to A Woman's Worth. So it's not just for women who have somebody in incarceration, whatever the loved one is, son, daughter, husband, whoever that is, and it's certainly a tremendous asset for those people. But for every woman reader in the world, this book will impact your lives in a way that we didn't even dream or imagine. We've gotten so many testimonials about this book and what it has done to change the lives and the thought process of women. Because if we take responsibility for our actions, and that's something that we just don't do. Women get involved with men who are not responsible, and then they have children by these men who are not responsible. And so we have single parent families, which puts a great responsibility on the rest of the community, because you have these children who have no father in the home, and we already know the statistics prove what happens when we don't have fathers in the home, and then the government is left to take care of these children because we weren't held accountable from the beginning.
I know someone is interested in getting your book. How can they get your book?
The book can be ordered at wisdomcries.info. My book, The Woman's Worth, and book, Straight Talk, can both be ordered online at wisdomcries.info.
I think that's really, really powerful. Here's a man that has gotten out of prison and wrote his own book, and has published his book, and now you wrote a book. And tell us again a little bit how they can get this book, and maybe a telephone number real quickly.
Okay, wisdomcries.info, that's wisdomcries.info. The phone number is 816-561-2809.
I hope you have enjoyed this broadcast. You have been listening to Miss Tanya Brown telling her story.
1, 2, 3. Here in my problem, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know. Maybe I'm supposed to cry if nobody ever knows the way I feel. That's alright, that's okay, cause I'm gonna make my world a better place. Gonna keep that smile on my face. Yeah, I'm gonna teach my...
We hope you enjoyed today's show, and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. To find a link to audio of today's show, our calendar of events, and more, check out Jaws of Justice Radio on Facebook. To contact us, send an email to JawsOfJusticeRadio@yahoo.com. And to find out about future shows, check us out on KKFI's website, kkfi.org. My name is Jeff Humfeld. We thank our engineers, Joe Henderson and Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Friday. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then, round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale. Today's outro theme music is Better Man from the Playing for Change Songs Around the World CD.
I'm gonna get back up. It'll be alright. It'll be okay. Well, I'm gonna make my world a better place. Go keep that smile on my face. Gonna teach myself how to understand. Gonna make myself a better man. Yeah, I'm gonna make my world a better place.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following segment, courtesy CBS News.
5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan left 35-year-old Army Specialist Scott McDonald with chronic back pain. His wife, Heather, says over the course of a year, VA doctors in Columbus, Ohio, prescribed him 8 pain and psychiatric medications.
it just got out of control. They just started pill after pill, prescription after prescription.
Wait, he would go for follow-up visits?
Uh-huh. And he'd come home with all brand new medications, higher milligrams.
Then, a VA doctor added a ninth pill, a narcotic called Percocet. Later that evening, Heather came home from work and found Scott disoriented on the couch.
I asked him, "You didn't by any chance by accident take too many pills, did you?" And he's like, "No, no. I took what they told me to take, Heather." And I propped a pillow under his head, and that's how I found him the next morning, exactly like that.
He wasn't breathing.
The coroner ruled McDonald's death accidental. He had been, quote, over-medicated and died from the combined effects of five of his medications.
There's an overuse of narcotics. It's the first reflex for pain.
Dr. Phyllis Hollenbeck, currently a physician with the Jackson, Mississippi VA, raised her concerns with the federal government about the VA's practices for prescribing narcotics.
The people in charge said, "We want you to sign off on narcotic prescriptions on patients you don't see." I was absolutely stunned, and I knew immediately it was illegal. It works on the surface. It keeps the veterans happy. They don't complain. They're not coming in as often if they have their pain medicine. And the people in charge don't care if it's done right.
We obtained VA data through a records request, which showed the number of prescriptions written by VA doctors and nurse practitioners during the past 11 years. The number of patients treated by the VA is up 29%, but narcotics prescriptions are up 259%. A dozen VA physicians who've worked at 15 VA medical centers told us they felt pressured by administrators to prescribe narcotics and that patients are not being properly monitored.
I have seen people that have not had an exam of that body part that they're complaining of pain in for 2 years. It's easier to write a prescription for narcotics and just move along, get to the next patient.
This doctor, who presently treats pain patients at the VA, asked not to be identified.
We're letting people come in and prescribing massive doses of narcotics. And they also are on drugs for mental health problems.
Our guest on the most recent Cultural Baggage Show, Congressman Beto O'Rourke, spoke extensively about this situation regarding veterans. Please check it out. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.